163 million children is the figure today that are orphans. 163 million. Now, when we hear that number, it's just kind of thrown out. It's a number. How can we even get our head around that? Well, here's one way to think about it. If you looked at one face every second a new face of an orphan child, it would take you 5 years and more without a break. That is a sobering thought. So when we hear that, what do we do with it? Well, some people said we should build more orphanages so that these children will have a place to stay. But actually, that's not the best solution, is it? That's only a temporary solution. It is, in a way, a refuge for them, but God has designed families to provide that refuge. It's an extension of God's care. And there's a man named Russell Moore. He went to adopt two children, I believe, and he went into the orphanage there, just to give you a picture of what an orphanage can sometimes be like. They walked in and it was silent. And he started thinking, why is it so quiet in here? There's full of children. Full of children in here. This is actually from an article that Christianity Today printed in July. I'll just read a section. He and his wife were there. He said to his wife, why is it so quiet? The place is filled with babies. Both of us compared the stillness with the buzz and punctuated squeals that came from our church nursery back home. Here, if we listened carefully enough, we could hear babies rocking themselves back and forth, the crib slats gently bumping against the walls. These children did not cry, because infants eventually learn to stop crying if no one ever responds to their calls for food, for comfort, for love. No one ever responded to these children, so they stopped. Sobering word for us that children will even stop crying if they know that nobody will hear them. Nobody will come to them. Clearly, they need a refuge that is different than just an orphanage. Orphanages are worthy, but they can only go so far. And so, we think about Ruth and Naomi. They needed refuge too. They were vulnerable. They were broken. How are they going to get out of the situation they're in? And we know this too, don't we? I mean, we might not be orphans. We might not be widows. Some of us are. But we know in our lives we try to find help. We try to heal from pain. We try to get to a place of rest because we are unrestful. Sometimes we seek it in the wrong places. We look all over. You know people who are in cycles of abuse. They're caught in cycle of drugs. And you know people who even will be like those babies, where they don't know where else to turn and they'll just rock themselves. They'll just comfort themselves to sleep. And it's a picture that we really cannot fix our own brokenness, can we? We need a redeemer. And Boaz here is a great picture of who God is and how he deals with his people. Naomi here is seeking rest, right in the first verse. My daughter, should I not seek rest for you? She's seeking, wants to seek rest for Ruth. And so she tells her how. I have a plan. Let's see what God will do with this. And so how do we seek refuge in the Lord? Four things this morning. The first is with obedience. We see this in verses 1 through 6. Naomi has this plan. She tells Ruth, and this is a bit confusing to us, isn't it? Well, what are all these things that she wants Ruth to go do? Well, he's winnowing barley. Well, what does winnowing barley mean? Well, the way they would do it is they would lay the barley on the floor, a hard surface, and they'd have the animals walk around, and they would step on the barley and separate the grain from the husk. And then they would take all the stepped on pieces there and throw it up into the air, and the husk would be driven away by the wind, and the grain would fall back down. And so that's how they would get their grain. Well, Boaz is out doing this. It's part of the harvest. And so Naomi tells her to wash and anoint yourself and go down there, but don't let him see you. Well, some people would say that washing here and anointing is actually her, she's changing out of her widow's clothes. She's no longer being symbolized as someone who's mourning for her husband, but it's time now to anoint herself. We even see that in 2 Samuel 14, where someone was coming to try to trick someone else that they were grieving, and so the instructions were, do not wash yourself, do not anoint yourself, but put on the clothes of grieving. So we know that when the grieving period is over, it's time to wash and anoint yourself. So what does Ruth do? Verse 4, she's told, when he lies down, look where he lies and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. We actually don't know much about the customs from way back then. What was happening here? We don't know all what's happening here. But we do know that Ruth replied, all that you say, I will do. There's no, you know what? Actually, I'd like to do it a little bit differently. How about we do it this way? It's not like, no, I want to do it my way. She was not doing that at all. And I know for some of the kids here, you know that if your parents ask you to do something and you say, okay, I will do it, but then you never do it. You're not following through with what you said you would do, were you? So Naomi, Ruth here, she could have said, okay, I will do all that you say, and then she could have gone down and done something totally different, but she didn't. She did what she said she would do. Look at verse 6. She did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. This word ought to jump out to us. This was not just a suggestion. You know, I think it would be a really good idea if you did this. No, this was a command. You must do this. I will seek your rest. This is what you are to do. It wasn't a suggestion, and God has given us commands in His Word, hasn't He? Not just suggestions. And if we are honest with ourselves, we really don't like being told what to do. A lot of us don't. But God here is seeking rest for you. The reason He gave you commands is because He was saying, this is the best way for you to live. This is how it will be well for you. This is how you will find rest. You will be my people. Walk in my ways. And we read in Hebrews, those who were not obedient did not enter his what? His rest. And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? A whole generation of people wandering in the desert. They didn't obey God, and so what? They did not come into the promised land. They didn't enter his rest. So obedience and rest is tied together here. And then we have Jesus. Because we know that we cannot obey perfectly, can we? We know that we haven't kept the law. We know that we haven't done everything that God has commanded us to. And so Jesus says, come unto me, you who are weary and heavy burdened. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your soul. So now we come to the Lord Jesus, Jesus frees us to obey. He has enabled us to believe and obey because he has obeyed perfectly. Well, we don't just find refuge with obedience. We seek refuge in the Lord also with humility. Look at verse 7. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry, he went to lie down. She came softly. Softly means she came quietly. She uncovered his feet and lay down, and at midnight, he was startled and turned over. This is almost humorous, because I know some of you, when you're woken up in the middle of the night, you react in different ways. Some of you jump right out of bed, and you're like, right there. And what's going on? What was that noise? Who's crying? And others of you, you never even hear anything. You don't wake up, or if you're startled, you just start mumbling. You think you're lost in a dream. That's me, by the way. Karen's good. She'll jump right out of bed and be right there. What did I hear? Sometimes. Oh, we laugh about that. But here, Boaz, we don't know if he was groggy or not, but I love how the Bible puts this. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Not an everyday occurrence, certainly. And he says, "Who are you?" He can't see her. What does she say? She says, "I am Ruth, your servant." Now, there's some debate whether or not this was a sexual expression or anything going on here. I don't believe it is at all, because actually the grammar in the Hebrew does not support that, whereas other places, commentator said that it does reference that, but here it does not. Also, with the context we have in chapter 4, she is laying at his feet, I believe, because she is demonstrating, "I am your servant. I am at your feet." That's where a place of a servant would be. And what does she ask him? She says, "Spread your wings over your servant." We think at this point Boaz could be really deluded here, right? Or maybe it's Ruth. Does she think he has wings? What is happening here? What is she talking about? But actually, the word wings in the Hebrew is the same word for corner of a garment. So it's actually, they would wear these robes, longer cloak, especially as they're sleeping at night. She was saying, "Spread the corner of your cloak over me." Have we heard this before in Ruth? Look at chapter 2, verse 12. Boaz is the one to say to Ruth, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So here we see the wings of the Lord covering his people, and now Ruth is asking Boaz to cover and protect her. Well, if we were to water this down and say, let's get to the point here, what is she really asking? She's really asking him to marry her. She is asking him to marry her. There is some evidence of an old tradition that if a woman came and there was a proposal in sight, the man would actually throw his cloak over the woman to signify that he is going to marry her. Now, there's also, in this old tradition, the woman could walk away before he was able to throw the cloak over if she was going to reject this proposal. But here we see that it's a picture of the levirate marriage here. Has not Naomi already said Boaz is our relative? In other words, he can be a redeemer. Few different things that the Redeemer would do. He would produce descendants for the deceased man's family. He would provide protection for them. He would also provide a legal heir instead of Ruth going after someone else. You know, I think this is a great picture. Many of you are married. You've asked or have been asked, been proposed to. And I love hearing those stories of how did you propose, what was it like. But common to almost every proposal is what? Getting down on your knee, right? The man is going to ask a woman, getting down on your knee and to propose. It's showing humility. Showing humility. Well, some of you know the story. It's a old children's story, Beauty and the Beast. And if you know anything about that story, there's a beautiful girl who lives in the French countryside. She's always reading a book. She's not interested in marriage. And yet, there is someone who is very interested in marriage. He is the best hunter in the land. He is big. He's handsome. His name is Gaston. And he is determined to marry Belle, this beautiful woman. And he does everything he can to try to gain her attention. He even goes up and he sings a song about how he's going to make her his wife. But yet, she wants nothing to do with him. I think one of the reasons, and it's a great picture, he has no humility. He is arrogant. He's proud. I'm going to take her to be my wife. You just watch and see. I will have her. And he's going to do everything he can to get her, but he goes about it all the wrong way. He doesn't get down on his knee. He is not humble, asking her, saying, I will be your servant. And that's what we see Ruth doing here. Humility. I am your servant. Please protect me. I think one thing we can gain from this is we don't presume upon the grace of God. She did not come and say, well, this is part of the law, and you must do this for me. She didn't presume, but she came humbly. And so we don't presume upon God's grace for us, but we come with humility before Him saying, we need you. We need protection. We need refuge from you. We see this in Psalm 51, 57, verse 1. Listen. The psalmist says, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge. There's a humility there of the psalmist coming and saying, I need your mercy. Please cover me with your wings so that I will be safe and have protection, that you will be my God. I will be your servant. And now we see that fully displayed in the blood of Jesus Christ. There's refuge there. But there's more than refuge. There's redemption, where we are redeemed from our brokenness. Number three, we seek refuge in the Lord with faith. Look what happens in the story. What is Boaz going to say? And he says, first of all, in verse 10, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. How is Ruth laying at his feet kindness to Boaz? It's not to Boaz. It's to her family. In other words, she is concerned about Naomi. She wants to provide for her. She's not forsaken. Remember, she said, I will be with you until I die. She doesn't run after other young men. She doesn't look to see, are they poor? Are they rich? What can I gain for myself? But she's thinking of her family. And so she really steps out in faith here. She does not know what Boaz would say. It could have gone very wrong. He could have been startled and frightened when he woke up and ordered her to get away from him, not even bothering to figure out who it was, right? And so she stepped out in faith. And he says, he blesses her, and then he says to her, "Do not fear. I will do what you ask me to. You are a worthy woman. People have been talking about you all over the city. And you are worthy for what you have done, for who you are, looking at her character." And then we see the word, well, he says, "It is true, I am a redeemer." And then we see the word, "yet." Uh-oh. It's almost like, "Oh, yes, I will do these things for you. I have the means to do them. I will go, I'll work on this right away." But he says, "Yet, uh-oh, there's a problem. There is someone else who can redeem you before I can." There's faith that is needed here. She must trust in the Lord, that he knows what is best for her, and that he will bring about the plan that he has for her. So when we seek refuge in God, we seek it believing that he will be true to his promise. Because yet we have times in our lives where we come before the Lord and we say, "I need your help, I need your help. Can you please help me? Please provide for me. Please give me a refuge." And yet our situations are not instantly solved. We need faith that God will provide. And look what he says. He says, "I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." And then she gets up before it's light enough to figure out who it is so she can get back. He gives her all this barley. Says, "Hold out your cloak." It's probably she took her cloak and held it out. He filled it with barley. And then it says he put it on her. Now, if we talk about, if these are ephahs, which we talked about before, 4 gallons, 4 times 6 is 24 gallons. How could she possibly carry 24 gallons of grain back home? So we're thinking, one commentator said, I think it's not an ephah, but a seah, which would still be 88 pounds. He said, now for a nice strong woman, that could be possible for her to carry 88 pounds back to her mother-in-law. Now, he did put this on her, as it says, so we don't know for sure. But anyway, it's a large amount. He gave her a lot. He did not want her to go back. He's already providing for her, isn't he? What did she say in verse 17? "He said to me, 'You must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" Have we heard anything about being empty before? Verse 21 of chapter 1, Naomi says, "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Call me Mara, bitter. Don't call me Naomi, pleasant." And now we see the Lord filling her. She is no longer empty-handed. And finally, we see that we seek the Lord with patience. Look at verse 18, the very last verse. One of the hardest words for us to put into practice. She replied, "Wait. Wait, my daughter. Wait until you learn how this will come about." This is really hard for us, isn't it? We live in a time where we don't have to wait. If you want something, you go to the internet, you make a couple clicks, and it's yours. Then you have to wait for the free shipping, right? But we want an immediate solution. You even know this in your own lives. When you are in a spot of brokenness, when you are in a spot of vulnerability, you want, "I have to do everything I can right now to solve this." And here, Naomi says, "Wait." We need to relearn this, what it means to wait. It's hard, especially when we are vulnerable. Will he help us? Will I have my need met? Will he save us? This is common in the Bible. We see waiting all over. I think waiting is a good picture of our human lives. Think about when you plant a tree, how long do you have to wait to see it become 20 feet tall? A long time. God is not one of immediate results all the time. Sometimes we see that with God, but generally we are to wait. Think of Noah. Noah had to wait. How long after the water receded? He's in the ark. Can't I go out yet? We're resting on land. He's in a spot of where can't we get back to life? And he has to wait a long time. Abraham had to wait for a son. God promised him a son. I will make your descendants as many as the stars in the sky. And yet he had to wait. He got tired of waiting, didn't he? And so he had Ishmael, but yet God was providing Isaac. Moses waited 80 years to lead God's people. He thought he was ready at age 40. Remember, he went out, I'm going to lead. He killed an Egyptian. Now people will see what a leader I am. And they drove him out. He ran away. 40 years later, God said, now you're ready. The disciples waited in fear after Jesus died, didn't they? They were in darkness. They're vulnerable. They were afraid. People were going to kill them. They locked the door. And they had to wait. And now you and I wait. All creation waits to be redeemed. But Jesus has settled the matter through his death, through his resurrection. He has given his life for you. You don't have to wait for salvation anymore. Today is the day of salvation. That we believe in him, that he has paid for our sin, that he has given us his perfect life. And now there is still waiting, even for the Christian, that he is preparing a place. He is gathering those in. He's providing refuge. He's redeeming every day. Look at what it says in verse 18. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. God is not resting. He is not tarrying. He is working every single second of every day to redeem and bring in people, the refuge of those that need him. So know that God has not abandoned you, but he has adopted you. He has made you his child. He's brought you into his family through his son, Jesus Christ. So we return to, well, what about adoption? What about those 163 million children without parents? Dan Kruver, who's leader for Together for Adoption, says this: the gospel is the answer to the orphan crisis, not the church. Now that might strike us. The gospel is the answer to the orphan crisis, not the church. The church is the people through whom the answer is applied. So in other words, adoption in God through Jesus Christ, that reality which we know as Christians, the gospel is the answer to the orphan crisis. And we as the church are those to bring about the answer which it's applied to. So if we think, how can we demonstrate the gospel through adoption? Adoption isn't necessarily for everybody. It's not right for every family and every situation. So what can we do? Does that mean that we can't be involved at all? Absolutely not. On the back of this brochure, it says, how can you help? And the first thing is, you can pray for the millions of orphans worldwide. You can pray for them. You can give your time, your talents, your treasure. You can support a foster family or an adoptive family. You could start an adoption ministry in your church, or you can adopt a child yourself. How are we demonstrating God's refuge for the widows, the orphans, those who are vulnerable, who cannot care for themselves. We see Boaz doing that here for Ruth, a great cost. He was probably a lot older than her. We don't know for sure. But there was much sacrifice in what he was doing. And yet, he can do it with joy. And so can you.